This is the current federal tax developments for the week of September the 21st, 2020. Current federal tax developments is brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, coming to you this week from Phoenix, Arizona, and we're going to talk to you about a few key developments that took place in taxes this week. We're going to look basically at a discussion the IRS posted on their website, reminding individuals that you can apply for expedited private letter ruling requests if you're going down that path, and that COVID-19 would count for such for a reason to have such expedited requests. The IRS put out a web page that dealt with marijuana industry, kind of resources that impact there, plus a set of frequently asked questions in the area. We had a court case that looked at a taxpayer who seems to have had buyer's regret from deciding to set up an organization as a not-for-profit corporation, tried to decide, hey, maybe we don't want it that way, and I want to make an S election because this whole thing fell apart and there are all these losses. And turned out that didn't work out so well for the taxpayer. We have a couple of draft forms as well. We have a draft of the form that will be used by the self-employed to apply for their sick pay from the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act. And the IRS did finalize the form that's going to be used to amend prior Form 941s. So with that, let's go ahead and move ourselves back and let's take a look at what we're going to have our first ruling this week, or our first issue, which is an IRS news release. And this is news release IR-2020-212, issued on September the 16th of 2020. And this particular ruling deals with private letter ruling processes. The IRS is somewhat aware that because of COVID-19 pandemic issues, some taxpayers may have issues that need to be ruled upon that may be more time sensitive than normal. Now, as we all know, remember, the private letter ruling process does always involve user fees, or basically normally will involve the user fee. So it is not something to be undertaken with little reason, but there are cases where you want it. And so the IRS said, if you need a private letter ruling, Revenue Procedure 2020-1, which basically just copies what had been prior versions, number one every year of the revenue procedures is the one that tells us how to deal with the private letter ruling process for that year. But Section 702.4 of the ruling tells us about how we can ask for expedited requests. Now, the expedited request is made in writing. Right, it's got to be accompanying the letter ruling request. They need a factor outside the taxpayer's control, generally for this purpose, and we need to obtain this quickly to avoid some serious business consequences. They do remind you that you should basically submit those as quickly as possible because, obviously, first thing is you might not be approved, but secondly, you need it quickly. It's helpful to get it in quickly. Now, one of the nice things about this particular news release is they tell us that the COVID-19 pandemic is going to be considered for these purposes a factor that is out of the taxpayer's control. And that's going to be important because that's something we have to show before we can go for it. Now, there are going to be certain other issues, and we do have a revenue procedure, which is on 2020-1. Let's see, notice I say 2020-1, gives us more information on filing and other issues about how to do this. So we get this particular issue. It does tell you specifically how you're supposed to label those things, including labeling it as expedited handling as requested. See page X of this letter so they can explain what's happening. You do have to pay the fee ahead of time. For that reason, it probably is best for the taxpayer to have had informal conversations with the party you're going to submit the request to. Normally, they can tell you if you have a chance at all of getting a ruling you want. And I suspect they also will tell you if your situation is one where they are likely to approve expedited processing. So that makes a lot more sense to find it out before you send the money in than after. Now, remember, those pre-filing phone calls are not binding on the IRS. So you can't hold them to anything that's talked about on those conversations. But generally, they're going to give you the correct guidance as to where you're going. And only if when your detailed application comes in, there is something markedly different from what you discussed in the phone conversations you had, will they come back and say, wait a minute, you know, we aren't really going to go along with what we said on the phone because you didn't tell us about X, Y, and Z until you submitted this particular document. The IRS did also this year, because you may remember mailing things to the service has been kind of a problem. The IRS does note that they have a Revenue Procedure 2020-29 that sets forth procedures for electronically filing a PLR request. Now, it's a bit intricate, a bit messy, and there are a number of issues with it, but it does provide a method that's probably a bit more sure than these days submitting something and hoping when you submit it via the mail that it will get picked up. So basically, this is one of those things where if you do need to assist a client who has some specific issue that COVID-19's created and you need the ruling, you can go ahead and apply. Now, normally, remember, you don't tend to apply for a private letter ruling unless one of two things is true. Generally, the basic rule is this. You only apply for a ruling if you're still able to not do the transaction. And by that I mean, the problem is that if you get a no answer, you've already warned the service what you're doing, right? And you've got an answer saying it doesn't work from the national office, which pretty much means that when an agent shows up, they're going to follow that. And when the, appeals will do it as well, et cetera. You just don't want that history of having applied for it. You know, you can withdraw it and you won't get your money back. That's the other problem. So generally, we go for things that we can afford to live with a no answer. And then you try to do it early enough to get the application through. Normally, it takes 6 to 8 months, I found, to get these things run. And that's normally if you're lucky. I don't think today is going to be normal in any sense in this regard. So, yeah, it's usually helpful to think about maybe that you've got some time to work with. So even on expedited, I would say that if you're trying to expedite right now for a ruling and you need that ruling in the next, month or so or 2 months, yeah, we're sitting tight. It's going to be tough. You know, we're getting to the point where I think even under expedited, if you want to get it done before the end of this year, yeah, you probably want that ruling here real soon. Let's move on to the IRS published this week a webpage that deals with the marijuana industry on the IRS's website. It was published on actually last Friday on September the 11th. And what it has is an IRS page, and it has sections on various issues. So it's kind of a centralized location where the IRS will provide information that relates to the marijuana industry. They have a whole section discussing 280 Cap E and the industry. For those of you who are not aware, there's a problem with a marijuana business, and that is that under Section 280 Cap E, that business can only claim a deduction for costs of sales. Now, there's a long historical discussion about why that's the one thing you can do if you are selling a controlled substance that is illegal under federal or state law. And the main reason is because they weren't sure it was constitutional not to allow a deduction for cost of sales. But it is a little amusing that the one thing you get to deduct is the cost of the illegal item that's causing you to lose the other deductions. But that's the way it goes. So it discusses that. It discusses issues, too. It reminds people that you do have to report the income. Even though it's illegal, illegal income is still taxable. Don't believe that. Al Capone could have told you something about that little rule that, yeah, we have to do it. It has some number of discussions about cash payment issues and cash issues. A lot of marijuana businesses have to deal in cash because they have trouble getting banking relationships, and they may have trouble establishing bank accounts and other items that a normal business would have less trouble dealing with. So the IRS has a section of how those cash basis companies, not cash base, I say, just pure really cash, the green stuff companies, can go ahead about paying taxes and some discussions there. They remind them, too, though, that since they're a cash payment structure, if they get over $10,000 in payment in cash, they need to file the reporting form, and they have links back to the form to report a payment of more than 10 grand. Now, I suspect that may not often be something that you'd see if you were just a simple dispensary, that you're going to be selling it in excess of 10 grand. I don't know there's going to be people buying it from you to then attempt to resell it, given all the taxes and other issues in there. I got to believe if you're going to do it illegally, the black market's going to be way cheaper, shall we say, if you're going to be illegal anyway. So I doubt we have many of that. But if you're a grower and you're selling it to dispensaries that themselves can't get bank accounts, you may start receiving these payments of in excess of 10 grand. And you have to realize that you have to file those payment reports when that happens. And the fact that your industry is all cash this way is kind of irrelevant. You still got to worry about that reporting problem. Remind taxpayers that they're due on estimated tax payments for the industry, which are probably going to be pretty high because of that lack of deductions, and that you need to keep good records. Records has been a major problem in a lot of the court cases that have arisen for the marijuana industry. So it's really important to understand and get that straight. It also has a link to a number of frequently asked questions. So they put up that FAQ page at the same time, giving you some discussion about various issues, and also some more discussion about things like the more than $10,000 payment routine. They are emphasizing that for marijuana businesses fairly heavily, that they are concerned about that more than $10,000 payment structure. So I think you need to be aware that that's an issue that appears something the service is concerned with. And as such, you probably need to be a little concerned if your client's in that business with telling them that, yeah, that really matters for them. So, you know, we'll keep that running. Next on to a court case. This is a case of Deckard versus Commissioner. And this one is kind of a buyer's remorse case for a taxpayer. This taxpayer wanted to conduct this thing called Waterfront Fashion Week at the Louisville Waterfront Park. And he was going to do this, and he was told, he went to an attorney who suggested that he might want to do this as a not-for-profit organization because that might make it easier to attract funds from sponsors and the like. Now, you know, later he discovered that sponsors probably could have sponsored this event and gotten a deduction, even if it wasn't a not-for-profit or 501c3 organization. But nevertheless, he was involved. He was told to do this. And to a certain extent, I would say that just the fact they could get a deduction wouldn't really necessarily be the only reason why they might like a not-for-profit. But it was a not-for-profit corporation. Now, the problem is that this whole Waterfront Fashion Week turned out the one time they tried to run it to be a bit of a disaster, right? Did not make money. In fact, lost a lot of money. So it was unable to send the funds because they had set this corporation up as a not-for-profit corporation, and they had set it up to have the proceeds given to the, in this case, the Louisville Waterfront Park. I should say it would be the Waterfront Development Corporation that maintained the park. And so, you know, that never happened. So the taxpayer went back and said this, you know, there was nothing, this, it didn't work. The taxpayer itself had put a lot of money into this operation. And so the taxpayer tried this odd routine. He decided to try it late. I mean, this is like years late. He tried to file an S corporation election on behalf of this Kentucky nonprofit corporation and be able, therefore, to claim the losses. Now, we're going to, you know, worry about this, but, you know, he's late, et cetera. There's all kinds of problems. And the IRS said, look, the election is not valid. And they said, even if it was, we don't think he was a stockholder. Well, the tax court decided to just worry about the second one there. Generally, nonprofit corporations don't issue stock. You know, and in fact, the Kentucky law specifically said there's no stock to be issued. The Articles of Incorporation for the corporation said the same thing. There would be no stock to be issued. And of course, you know, S corporation, if you don't own shares in the S corp, you're not going to get a flow through deduction regardless of whether the election is valid or not. So the big issue they came down to was, you know, does this thing, you know, is he a stockholder? Well, the taxpayer said, well, I should be considered the beneficial owner of the stock because essentially, even though maybe I don't really have stock, in reality, I run the whole thing. I'm in charge of it. And so therefore, aren't I like a stockholder? The tax court said, yeah, we got to look at this. First thing is you don't actually hold stock. So now we got to figure out, is the interest you hold like stock? And of course, you know, we all know that LLCs, if qualified, if they are eligible, can elect to be treated as a corporation and can make an S election. So actual issuance of stock, we would all agree, is not absolutely necessary. But the court said the problem is we need to have something that looks like stock. And under the Articles of Incorporation and under Kentucky law, a Kentucky nonprofit corporation is not allowed to make any distributions of profits or have any benefits inure to these related parties, which is, you know, he's on the board, he's running it. In essence, he's barred from receiving those benefits. And if the corporation were to be liquidated, it had to send its any assets that were left over after liquidation had to be transferred per the Articles of Incorporation to a 501c3 organization. Now, the taxpayer said, well, wait. Okay, I understand that, but really, it was a mistake. I didn't understand all of this stuff. And look, we never even went and applied for tax-exempt status after everything kind of fell apart. You know, we never even completed that. We didn't go forward. You know, I went ahead and just started running it. And therefore, really, it was just like a for-profit. And so I want to argue that, in fact, it's substance over form. I'm really a shareholder. Well, the tax court went through and said, look, there are three big problems with what you're telling us. Number one, you don't have stock and you're barred from issuing anything that would look like stock. The test we're going to use for whether something is stock for an S corporation is, do you have a right? Do you have the rights that a stockholder would have? And one of the key rights is a right to distributions. And you don't seem to have any of those rights to distributions either during the year, you know, to get your return on investment, nor do you have a right to distributions in liquidation. So those are basic rights a stockholder would have, and you don't look like a stockholder then, because you have no such rights. You also aren't like a stockholder for those same reasons. Your rights aren't there. It can't be. And finally, substance over form generally doesn't work for a taxpayer. Now, we've discussed it before that generally, if you're in control of the form of a transaction, you really can't argue that the substance is not the same as that form. Because if you're in charge of the form, you happen to control what that form is. He could have easily said, it's not a mistake that you guys formed a not-for-profit corporation, nonprofit corporation, I should say, under state law. He said, it was discussed. It was a straight decision. It's not as if you didn't know that's what was happening. So there were valid reasons you did it. You never changed the form or took any actions that would allow you to change the form, and you probably couldn't. And the mere fact that you don't apply for tax-exempt status with the IRS is irrelevant. When you talk about that, you're confusing state law rules, which govern your rights on distributions, with federal tax law rules, which are just dealing with the tax aspects of taxing that entity. So yes, we'll agree that's not a tax-exempt organization for federal tax purposes because it never went through the proper processes. But that doesn't matter because it's still a Kentucky nonprofit corporation, and Kentucky law bars you from having the rights you'd need to have to be considered a stockholder. The IRS put out recently, and it got more coverage this week, but actually it was issued by them in draft form on September the 2nd, Form 7202. This is a form that you might have forgotten was going to have to come out, but it is a form that gives a credit to self-employed individuals. That's basically, if you remember, under the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act, we had six criteria under which we could be, as employees, have the right to take paid sick days, subject to a cap. And the caps were different based on whether we were with the first three criteria, which was a COVID-19 problem that we personally had, or it was a COVID-19 problem that some sort of related party had. In that case, we got a lower sick pay, but a mandatory 2 weeks of sick pay. Now, also got, and that was paid for by a tax credit that your employer would get from the IRS. Well, the self-employed can qualify for that same credit for themselves. As well, there's a second credit that was paid family leave. Now, technically, it's 10 weeks, but it was a weird one, you may remember, where the first 2 weeks are unpaid. But the particular leave that allows you to do this is taking care of a child due to COVID-19 closures and the like. So basically, you would qualify under the first criteria to get the taking care of others lower credit, or potentially you could qualify for those first 2 weeks. If you yourself was diagnosed with COVID-19, you could get the full credit. So this Form 7202 is going to be attached to tax returns next year. That'll go in, and you can claim the credit as a self-employed. Right now, you do have to reduce the amount that you can get. The max amount is reduced by the amount that your employer has paid. So if you had a job and you were self-employed, you can't go over the overall maximums for what you could get for the credits. And there were maximums for each of the sick days, whether you were in the first three categories, second three categories, and also then a maximum for paid family leave. Those maximums are reduced by that. The other thing to remember, and I think this is going to be the biggest problem some of us are going to have with our clients in this area, is remember, it is a requirement that the taxpayer must show they were unable to perform services to get the credit. That's going to be an issue that clients have to understand they have to be able to demonstrate. The problem becomes, you know, the client may think, well, oh, no, I qualify for this credit, right? Because, you know, I was diagnosed, I went and got my test said I have COVID-19, so I just get the credit. And the answer is, well, not really. That's part of it. That demonstrates part of your qualifications. That's good. But let's say that you were an asymptomatic COVID-19 person, and, you know, the type of work you're doing, you always work in your home, you always work remotely or delivering things over the internet. Like, for instance, you know, these days I'm doing all my courses over the internet. So let's say I was self-employed doing these CPE courses. If I was diagnosed with COVID-19 and I was asymptomatic, which a good chunk are, I would have to isolate for 2 weeks, fine, but I could isolate and still do all these things I do to do courses. That wouldn't change anything. So bottom line, your client's got a document, and the problem's going to be your client's got to understand the IRS will go check and see, for instance, if I were, let's say, CPE instructor trying to do the same thing, the IRS can check and see if I had courses scheduled, right, during those 2 weeks. If I had courses scheduled that I gave during the 2 weeks, clearly I was able to perform services. You know, so they'll check for various things like that. If you billed for work performed during those 2 weeks, well, you're performing services. So remind clients, it's not just you get it automatically, you get it if you qualify. Now, the form looks like that. This is the form. There are two parts to it, part one, part two. Part one is the sick leave. That's the six categories. And it goes ahead and works through that computation. Now, that covers those issues. The second category is the one that is the family leave, which is when the most likely reason for qualifying for family leave is that you have a child who goes to school and the school's shut down, right? Or is doing all this, you know, work, it was just like teaching from home routine, or in a daycare shut down, those issues. So this could qualify a credit for that. But again, I got to remind you, remember, you've got to be able to show that at least to some extent you were unable, right? You were unable to perform services for at least certain days because of that. So you may have to break it over different periods. You may have to show why you were unable to. You know, the catch is there. Yes, supervising your child certainly is going to make you less productive. I think that's pretty given, you know, things like that happen. But the question is, if you still could, if you still were producing work and were charging, your client may have trouble in this area. So like I say, make sure your client understands that this is not a, hey, my neighbor says I get this because I got diagnosed with COVID-19. I was asymptomatic, but I got diagnosed, so I just get this, right? The answer is, no, it's not quite so right. You just get it. Whatever happens there happens, but it won't quite work that way. Finally, we had the IRS come out with a form that we discussed before that we were told you not to file things. And what happened was we have this 941X problem for the second quarter. And just to review what we had before on the IRS website, remember that the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act and the CARES Act made changes to payroll taxes, and they impacted second quarter Form 941s. And because of that, that meant that there were lines added to the 941. The 941X that existed at the beginning of this year doesn't have those lines. The revised Form 941X Therefore, we had to wait for that. You could only use the 941X that existed before only for quarter one 2020, 941 or earlier. You were supposed to wait on a second quarter revised 941 until this form came out, and it was supposed to come out sometime in late September. So you're waiting on filing for that purpose. Well, what's happened since is we now do have a new revised version. So the IRS now, it is out, and if you need it, it's going to be available on the IRS's website. So you can take a look at the IRS website, you can pick up the form. The key takeaway is make sure that the form you download and use is the one that says revision July 2020. And we've had more changes in the interim, obviously the payroll tax holiday and other issues. So we're expecting another revised 941X. For the third quarter and the like, and probably the same warnings will come in about not filing it if you don't, you know, until you wait until you get those changes, especially if you have a payroll tax holiday related issue when you file the form. So, you know, kind of keep your eyes out for that because that's going to be an issue going forward. Well, I do have some more CPE coming up, and I wanted to talk to you about, you know, what we're going to be showing and doing. I have a course now. I'm actually doing a course on Monday for New Jersey. We're doing a monthly tax update, but I suspect you're probably listening to this after that one started or after it's done, so probably you can't sign up for that. The first one you probably can sign up for next week, because the week's full for me on these, is I will be doing for Arizona on September 22nd in the afternoon a PPP loan forgiveness and other COVID-19 developments. This is effectively the same course I did in New Jersey on September 1st, and we're just going to talk about kind of walk through the PPP loan forgiveness routines, how they work, what you can do, and how you can help clients go for this. So it's available on the Arizona Society website. You can search in their continuing education for the date of September 22nd, and you should be able to sign up for there if you want to pick it up. We will have one more of these I'll mention here at the end of the week that we're doing for another society, and that other society will be New Mexico. Now, New Mexico Society of CPAs, I'll have 2 4-hour courses on the 23rd, one for the tax implications of the revised financial accounting rules and the conformity rule that Congress put in as part of Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as well as an afternoon session on accounting, auditing, and tax considerations for the cannabis industry. So we're going to talk about marijuana, which is timely since IRS just put out that guidance for that industry. And that course will cover a lot of details, but honestly, the big thing is always the tax issue, 280 cap E, and how you determine what is and what is not a cost of sales item, and specifically production versus retail or wholesale. And hint, you prefer to be a producer in the cannabis industry because you get a lot more deductions. We'll also then on Thursday, the 24th, I'll give a course on tax-exempt organizations, basic issues for operating, organizing, and preparing forms on that date. And Friday, the 25th, again, we'll be doing a session, and that one is in the morning, as I recall, on the 25th, the New Mexico Society, which is, again, the PPP loan forgiveness and other recent COVID-19 developments. So, again, if you want to pick that up, it will be a webcast. It's on New Mexico Society's website. So we'll be doing those. Now, this pretty much ends my CPE until we get past October 15th. Not surprisingly that there were not that much. It will pick up a lot more after that. So post October 15th, take a look in your state society catalogs. So far, I believe, except for a couple of possible dates that may be live, I think at this point, everything is confirmed to be webcast from here on out. There's a couple of chances that a couple of courses may still turn out to be really live. But like I say, I'm not sure I'm holding out a lot of hope in that area. A lot's going to depend how things continue to go on in the area of the whole COVID-19 situation. And frankly, at this point in time, it's just difficult for any of us doing live sessions to travel to go do a session, because you never know on the day you try to travel, you know, you're going to find out that a quarantine rule gets put up where you're going, or worse, I get there and then Arizona decides to quarantine when I try to come back from where I went. And, you know, that's kind of a whole mess. So, yeah, it's tricky until we get past, you know, until we get things a little more settled. But generally, the good news about all of that is it does mean that almost all these courses we'll be doing are available wherever you're going to be, because we'll be able to do it on the webcast. And we are trying to work these out to try to be a little better, more interactive, and more structured in that event. And remember, these State Society courses generally are going to be pure live courses, meaning that you will be interacting with me in real time, and during the course, I can respond, which is, I think, a lot more helpful than cases where, you know, we're having to go with a rebroadcast scenario where you end up having to deal with things in terms of texting messages back and forth. So again, take a look at that. We'll go. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of September the 21st, 2020. You can catch our updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You also can send questions or comments to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. My Twitter handle, @edzollers, and I post updates there. I do follow the Connect sites for the state societies for Arizona, Illinois, Minnesota, New Jersey, and Washington. So if you have issues and you participate in those sites, you post there. I will, if I see your message and, you know, I think I can add something, I'll try to step in on those. I also check in every so often with CalCPA's General Purpose Tax Talk Group, which is open to CPAs across the country. So everybody's open and available. Well, like I said, it's been an interesting week. I don't know if we're going to have a tax bill or not coming in. You know, we saw a little movement as if the whole issue about some sort of relief, you know, a new COVID relief bill might be passed before the election. I'm not holding out a whole lot of hope, but there was at least some movement this week. So we'll see if that happens. And if it does, we'll try to keep our eye out for what's going on. But otherwise, you know, have fun. We're heading toward now the trust deadline, trust and estate income tax return deadline on the 30th of September. And then obviously the big deadline on October 15th. So hopefully you get your rest, you know, take care. Don't get too stressed. And we'll see you next week. We'll talk about what's been happening for further current federal tax developments.